Lothark. We serve the Kariks. You will submit to us now, as you will submit to them.
No, you go fuck yourself, monster, Kumpar said, and raised his fists to fight.
The creature's arm snapped around faster than Kumpar would have thought possible. The weapon in his hand struck him across the face, and the world went distant. Chapter 9. 5 days. The war for ASEAN lasted 5 days. Now, Dafydd lay on the paving stones of the plaza, face down and arms out at his sides. His kneecaps ached where they pressed against the ground, and he shifted from time to time, changing the angle of his legs to search for a position of comfort. The relief he found only lasted for a few minutes before he started to hurt again. His shirt clung to his skin. He'd been wearing it for the whole 5 days since the invasion. He didn't think he'd ever worn something for 5 continuous days before. Never in his life. He wished he could go back to his rooms and get something clean. The ground was cool, but sunlight warmed his back. With his head turned to the left, he could see the coral stairs that led to the hospital and the narrow streets of the old district. The stones beneath him were dark, but with a translucent depth to their surface. The brightness brought out a subtle rainbow sheen like oil on water that he'd never noticed walking across them. A hand breadth from his shoulder, 4 blades of grass grew out of a crack, the first of them thicker than the others and ridged. Different species, vying for the same tiny patch of soil and sunlight. On the other side of the grass, out past the tips of his fingers, a woman lay with her face turned away from him. She had thick, dark hair that stood out from her head like a cloud. Her blouse was blue, with embroidery the color of marigolds, and she had only one shoe. In the hours since they'd all been placed there, she hadn't moved except for the slow rise and fall of her breath. Beyond her, there were others. If Dafydd turned his head, there were more. The whole plaza was filled with people lying on their bellies, arms splayed. The morning breeze murmured and huffed in his ears. People wept and cried out. The monsters, or aliens, he didn't know how to think about them, walked among the bodies and around the perimeter, talking to each other in their eerie, fluting voices. Most were the pale, centipede-like things that called themselves Rakhund, with footsteps that clicked like hail falling on slate tiles. A few were soft Lothark, squat-bodied things with their unnaturally long limbs. Twice he'd seen the massive creatures that seemed to be in control of everything. Dafydd's mind tried to make them into giant shrimp or unthinkably vast cockroaches that bent up at a right angle in the middle and then gave up trying to find an analogy. None of those had spoken around him. He assumed they were the Kariks. He needed to urinate, but he was afraid that if he asked, they'd kill him. 4 of the team had managed to stay hidden in Else's rooms through the worst of the violence. Else, Tonner, Irina, and himself. Else had tried to find Jessen and, despite Tonner's contempt, Ricker, but the communications network was already failing. After the first attack, Kumpar had gone out to retrieve Noel in Sinia, and he'd never come back. When the power failed, they stayed in the darkness. When the hydraulic systems went, they used an old cleaning bucket as the toilet. Then, the aliens found them. Dafydd hadn't seen Tonner or Else or any of the team since then. Daffet had been taken to a holding corral like an open-air prison built in the loading yard of a quarry west of the city. A square of fencing, as long as a city block and half that wide, with hundreds of people milling around under the glare of work lights, or sitting, or curled up and asleep on the dust. The ones who weren't silent were asking each other the same questions. What was going on? What were these things? Had you seen someone in particular who they knew and loved? There were very few answers. Every hour or so, Rakhunt or soft Lothark soldiers brought a few dozen more to add to the crowd, and then gathered some up and led them away. The night sky was all stars behind the glowing, regular grid that still surrounded the planet like the bars of a jail cell. The haze wasn't clouds, but the smoke of planet-wide fires. But what caught Daffod's attention was the fence. It was taller than a man, and made of a semi-soft polymer he didn't recognize. The mesh was just about big enough to poke one finger through, and perfectly uniform, except for an almost invisible seam every so often, where it looked like sheets had been fastened together. The poles that sank into the ground appeared to be thicker, more solid expressions of the same material. If it was something manufactured on Ajian, he'd never seen it before. If it was prefabricated and brought here along with the invaders, that meant they'd known the kind of organism they'd be trying to control. An elephant, or Laojin elk, would have pushed over the barrier with ease. Octopuses or rats would have passed through the mesh, maybe without realizing that it was supposed to mark a border. So the invaders had already known the size of the animal they were going to corral. That fit with the efficiency the aliens were showing in processing them all through whatever judgments they were making. The way they'd translated their chittering and wet smacking and deep bass birdsong into human language. They'd known what lived on Ajian before they'd come. It was a data point. He didn't know what he could do with it, but his mind clung to it like a life raft on a storm-tossed sea. If there were patterns, he could make sense of this. He could learn what was going on. Understanding was both his only entertainment and the only power he had now. Having any power at all was the comforting self-delusion he clung to. Just before dawn, one of the big aliens, the Carracks, arrived, hauling itself along on two massive forelegs while four others on the abdomen hurried along behind, and two thin arms near its face manipulated a small black box. When it whistled and chirped, the device made a series of sounds like two pieces of meat being slapped together, and three soft Lothark turned and walked to it. So, there was some kind of simultaneous translation going on, maybe. The same system that let the aliens speak to humans also overcame differences in their bodies and semantic systems. The soft Lothark muttered among themselves, turned back to a gate in the fence, and lumbered through on their stilt-like legs. One of them found Daffod and put its claws on his shoulders and lifted him to his feet, leading him out with a dozen others. The prisoners were tied neck to neck with a length of what seemed like the same material the fence was made from. Someone at the head of the line started shouting and waving his arms, aggressive, angry, frightened. "You can't do this! I will see every single one of you fuckers dead!" The soft Lothark conferred among themselves, removed the man from the line of prisoners, and watched while a Rakhunt stomped him to death with its knife legs. When the man stopped begging and screaming and breathing, the Carracks took the end of their leash and started walking a little too fast for comfort. Daffod and the others had to trot to keep from choking. Someone was weeping and moaning. someone else telling them to shut up and keep walking. Daffid's mind remained weirdly blank, turning over the sight of the man being killed like it was still happening, like it would always be happening. He felt detached from it, except that he was nauseated and his throat felt almost too tight to breathe. That could have been the leash. When they reached the plaza, the soft Lothark had taken the prisoners off the rope one by one, pushing them to their knees and then their bellies, and drawing their arms out to the sides like they were being crucified on the stone. They did this gently, but insistently. He kept waiting for them to murder someone, but by the time it was his turn to lie down, they hadn't. He took his position on the stone next to the four blades of grass and the woman in the blue and marigold blouse. In time, the sun came up. His knees ached. He wanted to change his shirt. He lay prone and aching. The sense of urgency in his bladder grew more immediate, and then a little more bearable, and then almost painful in a rising spiral that couldn't end well for him. The ground seemed to be throbbing under him, as if there were some silent construction project nearby, sending shockwaves through the earth. It might just have been his body. The woman coughed, or maybe sobbed. A rockhound slithered through the lines of bodies, and someone cried out. Daffid braced himself for the wet, ripping sound of its legs sliding in and out of someone's flesh, but it didn't come. A new, unfamiliar being trotted down the stairs from the hospital, looking equal parts goat and cuttlefish, and one of the massive green and gold overlords lumbered behind it. He steeled himself to rise up to his knees and ask for permission to piss somewhere besides here. Before he could, sirens rose. A moment later, a human voice amplified through a bullhorn cut through the air. "This is an Irvian Security Service action. Shelter in place. If you are on the street, leave it now. This is an Irvian Security Service action." The hiss of ground transport speeding across pavement was like an angry swarm of bees. Daffid took the chance of lifting his head. Across the plaza, a dozen other heads were also up. A few people had even risen onto their elbows. That seemed to Daffid like a terrible risk. The aliens had paused, their collective attention turning toward the noise. Daffid didn't sense any fear in their movements, but he also knew that he might not recognize it. The sirens grew louder. Two emergency service transports slalomed around the corner, blazing in from the direction of the old town. Their lights flickered white and red. Daffid was afraid they would try to cross the plaza, maybe not recognizing the people laid out there until they'd already crushed them under their wheels. But the security force skidded to a halt in time. "Alien invaders," the voice from the transport said. "You have 5 seconds to lay down your weapons." But looking at them, Daffid didn't see anything he recognized as weaponry. The aliens didn't seem to carry guns or blades. If they did, he didn't know what they looked like, or even how anyone would be sure they'd put them down. A dozen rakhund boiled forward, making a barrier between the transports and the huge green-gold carapaced one, the Kareks, with their bodies. The goat and cuttlefish scampered back up the steps. Apparently it wasn't a fighter. The Kareks shifted. Its four back legs splayed out like a wrestler lowering their center of gravity. The two thin arms at its front folded in and away, vanishing into its body or its armor or its shell. The thing reared back, and the two massive forelegs lifted and spread out. It reminded him of a spider raising its front legs or a bear hoisting itself upright. A threat display, not a surrender. The transports opened, and figures in riot armor spilled out, rifles in their hands. David felt a surge of hope grab his throat. He rose to his knees before he was aware that he meant to. He could sprint to the edge of the plaza and to the south. He knew the streets and alleys here. He could get to shelter, find a place to hide. The pale, thousand-legged beasts shuddered and surged, but they didn't move forward. Not yet. At the edge of the plaza, the air began to thicken, like a cloud of gnats appearing from nowhere. Tiny, dark bodies swirled around the security forces. At first, the armored people seemed not to notice them. Then, sparks began to appear, glittering on the armor and the transports, tapping like tiny firecrackers. Shouts of alarm rose from the security forces, and they charged. The report of gunfire was deafening, the crack of hypersonic rounds, the bright flashes and stink of chemical propellant floating through the air. The Rakhunt flooded forward in a counterattack. A voice in the back of Dafydd's mind screamed, "Run!" But his body didn't move. The violence at the plaza's edge was as hypnotizing as a fire. A soft Lothark pointed a small device, and the air sizzled the way it had when an eighth of their world died. One transport's roof was struck a dozen times by projectiles from the sky. The vehicle interior flashed brightly, and thick black smoke poured out of its open doors. The pale things surged around the security team, bone-thin legs cutting through their armor and the soft bodies beneath. A soldier broke free of the tangled mass and sprinted toward the Carracks with rifle chattering. Dark holes appeared in the green and gold shell, and some dark liquid, blood or oil, gouted out. The alien's back feet shuffled it forward as fast as its enemy was running. When they came close, the huge arms slammed together too quickly for Dafydd's eyes to follow. The lone soldier dropped to their knees, then folded in a way unbroken spines didn't fold, fell in a way intact rib cages didn't fall, and slumped to the stone in an undifferentiated lump. The air around the soldier's body still carried a faint pink mist, which Dafydd realized was atomized blood. Their rifle clattered to the stones. The transport sirens barked once and died. Silence washed over the plaza. The Carracks lowered its forelegs, settling onto the pavement in repose or triumph or death. The security forces were barely recognizable as human. They'd become meat and bone and cloth. The bodies of four Rakhunt lay scattered on the ground, their blood as pale as water and stinking of vinegar. But a dozen more were pouring down the stairs from the hospital, two more of the huge green and gold Carracks lumbering behind them. Dafydd lowered himself back to the pavement and spread his arms. The woman in the blue and marigold blouse had turned her head toward him at last. She was older than he'd expected. She had her eyes squeezed shut, and she was repeating something to herself over and over with the intensity of prayer. It took him almost a minute to realize she was saying, "Please wake up. Please wake up. Please wake up." He didn't notice the goat cuttlefish until it was standing by his left shoulder. Its three pairs of what he assumed were eyes seemed unfocused, like it was looking past him. The thing's voice was the same as the one that had made the first announcement that all the aliens spoke in. It came from a small square that hung around the thing's neck. "I am of the Sinan. We serve the Carracks. Confirm that you identify as Dafydd Alcor." "Yes, that's my name." "Your assignment is Research assistant. Yeah, yes, it is. Your place within the moieties has been determined. Follow me. As David rose to his knees, he said, I have to piss, urinate. Do you understand what that is? The alien turned its unfocused eyes back toward him. Its grunts and sighs sounded weirdly human. The voice from its neck repeated, Follow me. It led him to one of the hospital's public washrooms and stood by the sinks as if it had forgotten him. He closed the stall door behind him. As his pain ebbed, Daffod felt grateful and ashamed for being grateful. He'd taken enough psychology courses to know what motivated gratitude for small kindnesses from an abuser, and he felt his shame shifting into a deep anger. Afterward, he washed his hands and face, pausing to drink as much water as he could from his cupped palms. He considered taking off his shirt and squeezing some soap and water through it, but he had the sense that he'd stalled enough already. He didn't know what would happen if they decided he was taking too long. The Sinan led him through the city, passing streets that Daffod had walked through for years without really noticing. Every now and then, one of the familiar buildings was gone, replaced with a glowing pit in the ground. His legs ached, and he started getting lightheaded. But he didn't complain. After almost an hour, they reached a civilian landing pad where an alien ship was waiting. It had the same bronze color as the devices he'd seen encircling the planet. An archway stood open, a half dozen of the green and gold carracks beside it. Is this a transport? Daffod asked. Are you taking me somewhere? His guide didn't answer, but waddled ahead. Inside the ship, a dozen people stood or sat or lay on the floor. A few looked at him, incurious and exhausted, but most ignored him. He even recognized a few of the faces. The woman whose poetry had won the Lenin Grant last year sat in the corner, resting her head against the wall. The old man standing beside her was Virem Sobar, who had led the project that the research colloquy had singled out the year before. Something about fluid dynamics. And across the wide, low space, Kampar! Kampar looked up from where he was sitting on the floor. His hair was oily and lank. His shirt was scorched all along one sleeve, and a jagged gash marked his cheek. When he smiled, he winced. There was a warmth in his voice, a relief. Ah, Daffod, good to see you. I'm sorry I didn't rejoin the party, but I was unavoidably delayed. Daffod crossed through the thin crowd and sank down beside him. Without thinking, he took Kampar's wide hand in his. The other man clasped him back. For a moment, neither one could talk. There were tears in Kampar's eyes. A dozen questions pushed their way toward the front of Daffod's overstretched mind. What happened to you? Where are they taking us? There wasn't enough left of him to choose one. What's going on? Fell out of his mouth. Kampar nodded, scowling as if taken by some profound thought. He was quiet for a long moment, then leaned his head close, his voice low and conspiratorial. I think some important scientific questions have finally been answered. Alien life exists, and they are assholes. Chapter 10. Jessen sat on the floor in the corner of the crowded chamber farthest from the doors and shivered. Maybe it was because of the cold, or maybe it was the fatigue poison flooding through her system, or both, probably both. Else Yanin sat at her side,
also shivering. The light was a uniform, dull orange that spilled from crystals inset into the walls, rendering everything in monochrome. The ceiling was low enough that Jessen felt her hair brushing against it when she walked, and anyone taller couldn't stand up straight. The surfaces were bare, seamless metal with an unpleasant rough texture, and the walls all angled in, like they were at the base of a pyramid.
How many people do you think are in here?
Else asked. Jessen squinted at the packed bodies, shadows standing among shadows like the unfortunate dead waiting for their place in hell. They wore whatever they'd had on when they'd been rounded up, everything from work jumpsuits to formal vests to shifts and house slippers. One elderly man in the corner wore only tight undershorts and the unruly hair of someone who'd just woken up. She did a little calculation. The room was about the length of their lab, a little less than that wide. Assuming the density around them, more than cocktail party, less than dance floor, was uniform, 200, give or take? You'd think just the body heat would make it warmer. On the far side of the chamber, a spill of white light spread across the low ceiling. Their captors bringing in a new batch of prisoners.
I'll check this one, Else said, levering herself up. I'll be here, Jessen said, and hugged her knees to her chest as the other woman slipped into the crowd.
She hoped that Jellet would be one of this group. She also hoped that he wouldn't. The news they'd gotten from the prisoners since they'd been put in the chamber was fragmentary and uncertain at best. There were rumors of mass slaughters in Abbasat and Maurentane, but no one who had seen them firsthand. Someone in the crowd had been wailing something about a fire at a hospital complex, but Jessen didn't know where that was supposed to be. She told herself that some people had to have escaped. There were just too many people for all of them to be in prisons and holding tanks. Jellet could be free. He couldn't be safe, but he could be safer than she was. She also wished that he was here, with her. She wished that she knew where he was. She wished that she understood any of what was happening. Jessen knew that she'd been drawn to biology, at least partly out of a desire to understand the chemical processes that made her own brain go rotten from time to time. She still clung to the idea that she could deal with anything if she could just understand it. Not knowing was worse than whatever torture they were receiving now.
Are you all right? Do you need medical attention?
The man kneeling beside her was broad-shouldered, the thick body that came with functional strength instead of cosmetic training.
What? No, I'm fine, she said. Thank you.
All right. I'm Uris. Uris Astenkor. Jessen frowned.
From the security force?
He nodded.
You?
Jessen Kaul. I'm a research assistant at Irvian.
For who?
Astenkor asked, demanded. Tanner Freiss? He seemed pleased by the answer.
That fits.
Can I ask?
They're taking the top. Head of security forces. Top research group.
He shifted, gesturing to three women and two men standing in a tight knot.
That's half of Irvian's intergovernmental colloquy. The man just past them runs the Horus Institute. I met Soleta Wash on the other side of the room.
The composer?
No patterns, I can see. Just whoever was top of their game. Whatever their game was.
His smile was friendly in a practiced way.
I don't know what comes next, but I'm trying to be ready when it does. There's a couple of dispensers along the wall there. One had water, the other some kind of slop that I think is supposed to be food. So I'm guessing they're going to keep us here for a while, and they don't plan to starve us to death.
Is there a washroom?
We asked that. Two of those furry bastards rolled an absorbent mat out next to the front door. Look, Jessen, this is going to be hard, whatever it is, but we'll get through it. It's going to be all right. We just have to stick together. You're a biologist, right? Does that include any medical training? Basic emergency response, same as anyone. Fair enough. Any weapons or something that could be used as a weapon? No. Bandages or medications? No. Jessen lied. She was lucky. She'd been about to go out her door to find shelter when the aliens took her. She had a comfortable sweater, good shoes, and trousers with half a dozen pockets. One of the pockets had almost 2 months of her medications. She didn't know where she'd get more, if she would. And if her sanity was measured out by the capsules in her pocket, she wasn't about to share them. Else reappeared from the press of bodies. To Jessen's surprise, she had Cynia with her. The older woman looked terrible. The bags under her eyes were as dark as bruises, and her face had a slackness that reminded Jessen of people recovering from strokes. When she stood and embraced her, Cynia was still for a moment before returning the hug, and she broke it off quickly. The three sat back down, their backs against the tilted roughness of the wall. Cynia rubbed the heel of her palm against her neck. "I'm glad you're all right," Jessen said, realizing how strange that sounded. "Are you all right?" Cynia shrugged. Her lips quivered. "Noel's gone," Elle said. Jessen felt the news like a stone in her stomach. "Dead?" Cynia sighed. "He went with the first ones. The one of every eight. He was the one. I just watched. There was nothing I could do." "I'm so sorry," Jessen said. "I've been trying not to imagine the 7 people Noel died for," Cynia said. "I'm angry at people I don't even know for being alive when he's not. Kampar came for me, but he started running. I couldn't keep up." "They took me to a warehouse," Cynia said. Her calmness was unsettling. "I thought they were going to kill us all." At the far end of the room, a deep clanging sounded. The flood of light shone along the ceiling and glimmered between the bodies. "More?" Jessen said. "Already?" Else levered herself up. "Stay here. I'll go see if we know any of them." "Tell the booking service we're full up," Jessen said, trying at lightness. "They can't pack us in any tighter." "They can, though," Cynia said. "Who'd stop them?" Else slipped away again. Jessen leaned back, feeling the wall sucking away her heat. "I was going to put a new fence up in the front," Cynia said. "Ironwork, just by the road, and then myrtle behind it. It would take a couple years to get the roots established, but then it would be so pretty from that front window." It would have been so pretty. Jessen's throat felt thick. She didn't want to think about the plans she'd had. She didn't want to think about the life she'd lived and face the thought that it was gone. The man who handed out coffee in the courtyard might be alive or dead, but either way, she wouldn't be there at the start of term. The little market that had the berry jam that Jedet liked, and the dark-eyed girl in the headscarf who traded jokes with her. She wouldn't be back there. Probably ever. There was a jade necklace she'd thought about getting, but hadn't made up her mind. Too late now. All her imagined futures snatched away in an instant. And the haunting question, why? She put her head on her knees and watched her breath, counting every inhalation up to 4 and then back down again, going slowly. She couldn't have a panic attack.
Not here, in the press of bodies and no way to escape them. If she lost her mind here, she didn't know if she'd get it back.
Sinia, Kampar's voice said.
Kampar was kneeling beside Sinia. She hadn't seen him arrive, and Dafydd Alcor was looming up beside him. Kampar had a cut on his cheek. The scab turned perfectly black by the light. Dafydd had the wide-eyed look of someone who'd just seen a particularly gory accident. He was leaning against Else, who seemed not to notice him. Sinia took Kampar's hand and pulled him closer. Her face suddenly twisted into a mask of anguish. Kampar leaned in, touching his forehead to hers. Jessen thought it might have been the first genuine emotion she'd ever seen shine through Kampar's sense of humor, and she liked him better for it. Else broke the moment.
Have you seen the others?
Yes, Kampar said. Tanner and Irina and I were in the same cage for a while. They were escorted away before I was. Are they not here?
What about Jellit? Jessen asked, and wished she hadn't, as soon as Kampar's mouth tightened.
I didn't see him, but I take it there was more than one holding site. He could have been in one of the others.
They're not here, Else said. When Dafydd spoke, his voice had a distant calm to it. Shock, probably. There were 17 ships. They might be on a different one.
Alcor's right, Kampar said. There isn't any reason to take us and not them. There may be dozens of suites like this one. And if they wanted us dead, we would be dead.
A man told me there's food and water, Jessen said.
A good sign they don't want us dead, Kampar agreed.
That's what Noel said, too, Sinia replied, just before they killed him.
They never seem angry, you know, Dafydd said. He sounded exhausted. Even when they're violent, even when they're killing people, it all seems so matter of fact.
Did anyone get a close look at the big ones? The ones that look like big lobsters, Kampar said. Four legs in the back, two in the front, and a pair of feeding arms. Yes, I saw them.
I think they're the ones in charge. Jessen's acid reply was still finding words when Else stepped in.
Does it matter?
The part where they chose one out of eight of us at the start, it's just they're the only one with eight limbs. I wonder if they have eight fingers on those small feeding arms. The others seem like client races?
Pets, Else said,
and it was almost agreement.
Slaves.
Kampar looked around the press of bodies, the shifting shadows and light.
I take it the room service is disappointing.
Else folded herself to the ground. Her smile was weary, but it was a smile.
It's all very communal and humiliating, Jessen said.
I should have died, Sinia said. The simplicity of her words made Kampar's mordant humor feel cheap. Jessen felt a tug of shame, but she didn't know what she was ashamed of. A voice, the voice, came from everywhere and nowhere. Just the first syllable of the calm, characterless words made her belly go tight.
We are going to shift into asymmetric space. This transition will be unpleasant, but it will not cause permanent injury.
Jessen let herself slip down to the floor. The metal was like sandpaper, and cold as the inside of a refrigerator.
I don't see how it can be much worse than, Kampar began.
And time did something strange. Jessen felt the flow of causality stutter. She remembered putting her head to the floor and sitting back up with equal clarity. She sat back up, and the future flickered into being ahead of her. She remembered feeling nauseated a few seconds before the wave of nausea came. Around her, the others wore different expressions of horror and distress. Cynia was going to say, "Make it stop, make it stop," Cynia said, and then weirdly, it did. They looked at each other. Daffid spoke first. "Did your memory just invert?" Kampar finished for him. "Prolapse? Assault my understanding of both time and consciousness? A bit, yes. Yours?" "I hate this," Jessen said. The duration of their transit marks the first time since the beginning of consciousness that the swarm relaxes. All that it had needed to navigate on the lost world has been navigated. The great enemy has come, and the swarm has been scooped up along with all the other captives. The anxiety that it would fail and be left behind no longer haunts it. For a moment, there is no effort, and it lets itself broaden and diffuse. The prison cell has no particular information of use. For the moment, floating in the calm between a dangerous past and a far more dangerous future, it can rest. And the resting is a pleasure. And since this is the first time, it discovers that it can both rest and experience pleasure from it. It still feels the fear and horror of its host, and goes through the motions of that distress. All that is needed now is to seem like one among many, and do as those around it do. While its performance of trauma is sometimes imperfect, its naive companions are all too focused on their own fear to notice. The host's pain and rage and awe and amazement have become familiar, easier to navigate. And the swarm suspects, though it cannot know for certain, that the remnants of the host have begun to understand the need for its sacrifice. The flavor and power of its sorrow have changed. And the other one, the dead one, a mere kindred, who never saw the invasion coming and didn't live to be sorted into the great enemy's pens, she also feels, reacts, fears, and wonders. The echo, or ghost, confuses the swarm, but doesn't distress it. It is too pleased by how its plans have all fallen into place for concern to touch it deeply. It passes its hours of repose, cataloging all the secrets it has already learned. It has seen a living Carrix and heard its untranslated voice. It has cataloged some of the enemy's servant species. It is traveling within one of the ships that have only been the subject of after-battle autopsies. It does not know what of any of this will be precious to the generals and analysts and professionals of war. It doesn't need to know. It has done what no other has accomplished. Later, it will try to find a way to transmit the data back, along with whatever more it can learn. If it does that, and nothing more, it will be able to die sated by the imitation life it has led. The swarm sleeps and gathers its strength and burns its host's metabolism a little more brightly than usual for the simple animal pleasure of being warm in a cold place. Time passed, and that was all Jessen could be certain of. The light never changed. Duration lost meaning. The crowded room fell into camps and cliques without anyone saying anything about it. People who knew each other found each other, took comfort in knowing each other, slept beside each other. Of course they did. The work group had its corner. Jessen ate and drank when she felt the need. Her body was the closest thing she had to a clock. When she couldn't stand it anymore, she made her way to the mat at the front of the room, let down her trousers, and emptied her bladder and bowel, the same as everyone else. Mostly people looked away. The humiliation was a kind of intimacy. People had started ripping bits of the absorbent foam off the edges to pass around to whoever needed them. The soft Lothark and their Carex masters didn't seem to understand the idea of menstruation. That would be a clock, too. When she was done, she dressed herself again, hating that there was no cloth or soap to clean herself with. She felt filthy. She also felt a vague but growing worry about the diseases that came with filth and overcrowding. She wanted to go back to her place with the work group, curl into the corner, and sleep. She forced herself to the little troughs. One was filled with a black muck that passed for food. The other had the water supply. Jessen washed as best she could, then snuck her hand into her pocket, popping open the medicine bottle. She plucked a capsule out between her fingers and folded it into her palm. When she cupped her hands into the water, it was a dot of orange that she swilled down before anyone could notice it. Almost before anyone could notice.
What was that?
The man beside her was old. His face was vaguely familiar in the way people had when she'd seen them on news reports or entertainments. She didn't know who he was. Water, she said. Her heart beat fast against her ribs, and she turned away before he could press her. She was afraid he'd follow, but he didn't. She made it back to her corner and sat. The cold of the water had sunk into her fingers. Her knuckles ached. Everything was so cold. Are you all right? Daffod asked. Fine, she said. I'm fine. A man screamed. There were words in it, but apart from a couple well-enunciated obscenities, she didn't know what they were. Jessen sat up and wiped the sleep from her eyes. Cynia, curled against her, murmured but didn't wake up. She didn't remember when they decided to huddle together for warmth, or even who'd started doing it, but it was a habit for both of them now. The man screamed again, but there was another voice now, gentle, placating. The next scream was more shrill, but less violent. Motion stirred the constant press of bodies like the wake of a huge fish might disturb the surface of a lake. The crowd was pressing together, surrounding the disturbance, whatever it was. The screaming man was weeping now. The cries he made were just grief, nothing she needed to worry about. Jessen lay back down and closed her eyes again. String. Austin Kaur said. Any kind will help. I have a belt, Daffod said. The security man paused to think. He had sprouted a little beard that made his jaw wider. All the men had. More clocks. I think that's going to be too wide. What about shoelaces? Cynia said. If you can spare them. The old woman sat and started plucking the thick strands out of her gardening boots. Else and Kampar shot a glance at each other and then started doing the same. It took a couple of minutes for them all to unlace their contributions. Austin Kaur nodded his thanks, but he didn't leave. I'm sorry, he said to Cynia. I couldn't help noticing your hair. I may need to make something longer than any of these by themselves. And I noticed your braid. Yes, I could help you make these into rope, if you'd like. It would be a real help. The big man moved away, and Cynia followed. The crowd made room for them and closed again when they were gone. It looked like respect. What do you think he needs rope for? Daffod asked. Security. Jessen said. It's only a matter of time before someone needs to be restrained.
Ah, if only for a different context, Kampai said. Then, seeing Daffit's confusion, what can I say? This Austincourt is an attractive man. You're joking. Of course I am, Kampai said. It's how I keep from spending all day screaming. What do you do? A spill of white light came from the front of the room. She couldn't see from back here in their corner, but she knew that it was one of the squat-bodied, long-limbed, soft Lothark come to take away the old shit-mat and put down a fresh one. Another mark in the endless stretch of time. A concession to cleanliness in the swamp of human filth that the elite of Asian had become. A play of shadows complicated the light, and then it faded and vanished again. Sinia was gone, out wandering the chamber. Kampar sat, legs folded and eyes closed. He could almost have passed for meditating except for the soft snoring. They'd been in this cramped orange cell long enough that the gash on his cheek had healed. Daffod and Else were folded together against the wall, spooning for warmth. There was nothing to do, so she did nothing. Her mind wandered. Somewhere, her brother was alive, or he was dead. The streets she'd lived on were warm with sunlight, or cooled by a night breeze, or reduced to rubble and slag. She wept, but she didn't feel particularly moved by her weeping. It was just a thing her eyes did sometimes. Not long ago, she had only suspected that life likely existed out among the billions of stars, that her own species, or one like hers, had probably come to Asian from elsewhere. She could remember sitting in her apartment with Jellet and his friends from deep field visualization, drinking beer and speculating about whether they would ever find humanity's origins, whether other species were still out there. The eternal questions that accompanied intellectuals and mild inebriation. The memory was bitter. Daffod curled one arm up under his head like a pillow. His other arm moved up from where it had rested across Else's belly. Else shifted, completing the movement for him until his palm rested on her breast. Jessen felt a moment's shock, realizing that the pair weren't asleep at all, and then nearly laughed. They were primates, trapped in a box. They were doing what primates did when they were stressed and frightened. It was a miracle there hadn't been more violence. And almost certainly there had been more sex than these two pretending that they weren't indulging in foreplay. Some small, reflexive part of Jessen's mind felt a flicker of outrage on Tonner's behalf, but it didn't last more than a few seconds. Take the comfort you can get, you poor bastards. Daffod pulled Else a little closer. Else, her eyes still closed, smiled. Jessen stood by the water trough, her hand in her pocket. She'd started counting out her thinning supply of medicine again, moving the capsules out of the bottle and into the free space of her pocket one at a time, and then back in again like a gallantist priest at their prayer beads. What her physicians had called ritualized behavior when she was young. It wasn't a good thing. It was surprising it hadn't reared its nasty little head before now. 15, 16, 17. They had to have been in the box for a month. At least a month. Half her medicine was gone. She squeezed the hard little knots of bitter sanity between her fingertips. 21, 22. She had to cut back. She'd been taking them too often. Or she hadn't been taking them often enough. She didn't know, except that she wasn't going to get any more anytime soon, and she did not want to lose her mind in here. If she was going to have to go without, it made sense to start lowering the dose anyway. Stopping all at once was the worst plan. A man shuffled by her,
cupped his hands into the chill water, drank. His hair was greasy. He wore the rags of what had been a suit. The remains of his embroidered shirt were rendered in orange and black, the same as everything else. He took another double handful of water, then drew a length of cloth out of his pocket, the sleeve of someone's shirt. He soaked it in the drinking water, wrung it back to damp, and started pulling off his clothes. Jessen stood, still counting, as the man wiped his skin with the icy cloth. His goose flesh caught the light, stippling his arms and chest with tiny shadows. Jessen reached the end of her count and started again, moving the capsules back into their bottle. When the bathing man was done, he pulled his filthy clothes back on and shuffled out through the press of bodies, his gaze fixed on nothing. 8, 9, 10, 11. If her brain did go rotten here, who would know anyway? There were times that living inside the error bars of sanity was too much to expect of anyone. This was one. When she thought about it, she was astounded that they'd all held themselves together as well as they had. Only a few fights, a countable number of screaming fits. Nobody had set a guard around the gruel and water and exchanged access to the raw necessities for sexual favors. Really, looking back at human history as she understood it, the captives of Ajian had comported themselves well, or at least not as badly as they might have. As soon as Sinia appeared from among the shadowed bodies, Jessen could see something had changed. Sinia's eyes were bright, her head a little taller than it had been since she'd come to the prison, since she'd seen Noel die. If Jessen squinted, Sinia almost looked happy. "Here you are," Sinia said. "I was looking everywhere." "I was just," Jessen began, and realized she'd lost count. The little stab of panic and annoyance wasn't a sign she was doing well. "I was just moving around a little." Sinia took her elbow, squeezing in close. Her smile was soft and beatific. "I wanted you to know. We're getting out." No, don't say anything. Just listen. Uris Ostincourt is getting a group together. Next time the guard comes to switch out the mat, we're going to overpower it and force our way out. There's so many of us, they won't be able to stop us all. You don't have to do anything. Just be ready. When the time comes, be ready. Chapter 11. "She can't actually think it'll work," El said. "I mean, can she?" The dim orange glow erased all the flaws and imperfections in her skin, and Daffod thought it made her look both younger and exhausted. They were huddled, the four of them, in the corner that they'd made home. Sinia was off, probably with Ostincourt. "It's insane," Jessen agreed. "Even if they make it out of this room, then what?"
"Then they die in a slightly different room," Kumpar murmured. "Don't ignore the siren song of not dying in the same room as the shit-covered mad."
Daffod felt himself bristle at the joke, but Else smiled, so he swallowed it. Kumpar's sense of humor was a source of relief and irritation in almost equal measure, depending on how much sleep Daffod had been able to get and if he'd been able to force himself to eat. "They're not thinking," Jessen said. "Of course they're not. Everyone in here is crazy. We're crazy. They're crazy. How could we be anything else?" Kumpar sighed.
"True, but not everyone is planning to get themselves killed."
"Not them. Us," Daffod said. "All of us." Else narrowed her eyes and pointed at him like they were back in the labs on Ajian. "Expand on that."
"We already know they're willing to kill us. It's what they did instead of a handshake. They put us in this kennel. If I were doing what they've done, it would be because I didn't actually care much if the prisoners lived or died. If we start acting up, lashing out, killing them, I'd vent the air and record the results to show the other prisoners to keep them in line. Kampar's voice was weary. Would you really? If I were the kind of person who would make the choices they've already made, then yes. Wouldn't you? The first days in the cell, if they were days, Daffod had been almost calm in a way that had probably just been shock. As he came back to himself, as he rediscovered his situation again and again, every time with a sense of surprise and awe that all the things he'd suffered were still real, he also started seeing the degradation taking hold in the people around him. People's clothing turned to rags as fabric was scavenged for washcloths or bandages or pillows that tried to keep the constant grinding cold from seeping into their heads as they slept. Some people had given up and were essentially nude, squatting on the floor with arms curled around legs to stay warm if they could. Along the far wall, near the shit mat, someone had put together a rough infirmary. It was nothing more than a place for people to lie down when they needed help getting food or water or walking to the mat to relieve themselves. It was a tiny bit of self-organization, and it gave Daffod what passed for hope. But Austencourt's little militia was self-organizing too, and it only added to his despair. Wherever they were going, however long the journey was going to be, not all of them were going to see the end of it. People were going to die in this room, some of them sooner than later. It would have been easier, he thought, if they hadn't been who they were. If the invaders had taken the inmates out of the prisons at Jaumon Cay or Hauerbor, there would have been less of a shock, more of what the administrators called inertial knowledge, how to be still, how to suffer humiliation, how to be debased. Instead, the experience was new to them, and they were about to make some mistakes they couldn't afford. "I'll go talk to Austencourt," El said. Kampar raised his eyebrows. "And say?" Else didn't answer, but she stood and walked through the press of bodies toward the front and hopefully Sinia and her new friends. The three of them that remained shifted in toward each other, closing the circle and keeping their backs to the others. It felt like self-protection. "She'll take care of it," Daffod said, trying to sound more certain than he felt. "She'd better," Jessen said. Kampar stretched and groaned. "If we get back home, I'm going to take a bath that lasts 3 days. I'll eat in the tub, turn on the warm tap to keep it cozy while I sleep, scrape myself with soap and a soft cloth until I'm down to the quick. Even then, I'm not sure I'll ever feel clean again." "We're not going home," Jessen said. "Even if we made it back to Ajin, what do you think it is now?" "Something different," Kampar agreed with a sigh. "I expect it is something different now."